Hello and welcome to Sustainable Growth Out Loud, a podcast brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice, part of DC Thompson. I am your host, Julia Bottaro, and I am here with my colleagues, Heather Dinwoody and Felicia Jackson. Hello, how are you today?
Good, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Not too bad, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's nice to have a full house for once.
Well, it's been the summer holidays. You know, everyone's got to take a break every now and again.
So as ever, today we have three stories from the past couple of weeks. They are wildly different from each other, so we can just dive in and you'll find out for yourselves. I'm going to start with mine, which is not news per se, but I think it ties in really well with what's going on right now in the UK. We're going through a heat wave. Tomorrow there will be 34 degrees in London, which is a lot. And we are not very ready for it. For cooling, we kind of rely on fans and on air conditioning, but they are not the most sustainable solutions for reducing temperatures. So last week we published an interview that I did with Andrea Voigt, who works at Danfoss Climate Solutions, which is a Danish engineering company. And she told me about the wonders of district cooling. So the way that district cooling works is that there is a central plant, which is connected to a series of pipes that go through a certain area. So they go through certain buildings, you know, as it's in the name, it's district. So, and the central plant cools the water, which is then moved around the pipes, cooling the buildings. And then it goes back to the plant where it is cooled again and so on. And this is a much more energy efficient way to cool buildings. And it's not the only one. Of course, there are many ways. There are many technologies that we can implement to cool down buildings, cities, homes. But I think the point that I want to make is that we need to think about it. You know, this is likely the last heat wave of the summer for the UK, but we can just sit down and, you know, think that the worst is over until next summer, when it's very likely to happen again in a warming planet. And the UK doesn't have many plans for sustainable cooling, and I think it's something really important that needs to be thought about. And so in the interview with Andrea, we did discuss in what ways, you know, decision makers and policy makers can implement sustainable cooling strategies. So, you know, there are a range of ways that this can be done. There are incentives for businesses and also setting targets and so on. But we really need to work on this. I think it's very important. We do discuss a lot about heating because the UK is going through a cost of living crisis and people can't afford to heat their homes. But heating and cooling go hand in hand. You know, heating is winter and cooling is summer. So we need to have a holistic approach to this.
I think that's really interesting, yeah, because I mean, I remember writing about district heating several years ago and, you know, never even touching on the possibility of district cooling. I've always lived in the UK. I'm from Scotland. I've dealt with some very cold winters. But, I mean, recently I'm seeing more and more about it, whether it be sort of, there's a lot of nature-based solutions, so sort of tree planting in cities to kind of provide that cooling for the impermeable concrete surfaces we've got everywhere. And I discovered a startup just this morning actually that was making sort of technology enabled clothing that would cool you down. And
oh, is that Technique?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I came across them last week. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah. And I just thought that was fascinating because, you know, I've got one of those sort of heating up vest things, which I once wore to a rugby stadium to my parents' dismay, but it was quite funny. But yeah, so we're really sort of changing the way that we think about these things. And I think it's important to touch upon sort of the implications of extreme heat. You know, why is this such a problem? It's not a case of just, oh, I'm a bit sweaty today or something. You've got the health consequences. There's so many sort of premature deaths happening these days because of heat waves. And then you've also got the economic implications, you know, whether it's sort of, you know, railway lines can't function, they're all stretching and expanding and all that kind of thing. And then you've got agricultural production is failing. Like, there are so many impacts of heat that we need to understand. And I mean, I hope that we could sort of learn from other countries who are maybe a bit further ahead of us on this. But we also need to be ready to help them, to do what we can to help them, because as much as I hate to say it, a lot of it's not their fault. And I'm not saying it's solely ours, but you know, there's a justice element there as well.
Now, I'm going to bring something up which is sort of moving slightly away from the justice element, because that's the discussion about responsibility for climate change. But actually this issue of infrastructure, and I think it's really, really timely given the conversations going on at the moment about the failures to retrofit the rack concrete. But actually, one of the things that's really challenging in the UK is that we're not designed on an infrastructure basis for extreme heat. The country is designed for water and for cold. Even our buildings, you know, if you go across Europe, which has certainly been experiencing far greater heat than we have, you know, it's white buildings, it's the use of clay, it's reflective surfaces, it's very small windows. Our entire infrastructure is designed for a completely different temperature than what is currently being experienced. And the flip side, you know, we talk about heating and cooling being two sides of the same coin, but also the flip side of extreme heat and drought is that then the land is not capable of accepting water when there are floods later on, because that's the point about extreme weather. It's going from one extreme to another, as well as being more extreme in its impacts. So I think what this discussion of cooling, and by the way, I love, Julia, the idea of district cooling and cold water being run around the district, cooling everybody down. It works on a cycle.
And in the winter, you
turn into hot water, exactly.
Yeah, it can be perfect.
It does seem to be a really, really, really good idea. But this comes back to your point about holistic policy making, and Heather, your point about planning, which is that in the UK, our systems are centralised, the majority of them. We started with distributed generation, for example, you know, 150 years ago. It was all local electricity firms. But we have a centralised system for power. We have a centralised system for water. How do we actually go about solving these problems? Because, you know, it's one thing to talk about new developments where we can build these things into it. But how do we go about using lessons learned in other countries, in other cities, for homegrown challenges? And I think that's a challenge we're really not yet prepared to deal with on a political level. Because if you look at what's going on, politically speaking, what we're seeing again and again and again is decisions being made in isolation. And it seems to be on a very reactive basis. And I think one thing we all understand is that as the world gets hotter, as floods get worse, we can't afford to be in a situation where we're reacting to what's already happened. We have to look at how we adapt moving forward. We all have opinions about this.
So I was just going to say, I think there are some really interesting opportunities for collaboration here, as we always harp on about SG Voice. But, and you know, I haven't looked into this specifically, so I don't know sort of the technological differences between cooling and heating, but I know that, you know, with district heating, there are things you can do to kind of co-locate that with data centers or really heavy industries and harness that heat and stuff. And I wonder if maybe there's sort of a similar system that you could use with cooling. And again, I think this is going to be one of these things that, yes, policy is important. Yes, planning is important, but we also need industry stakeholders. We also need consumer onboarding, you know, all of these things.
Julia was interviewing Danfoss. Now, they've just launched an application development centre at a supermarket where they're practicing, well, not practicing because they're doing it, but they've implemented heating and cooling technologies so that these things are actually working together. So that's well worth taking a look at.
Going back to the word you said, reactive. And the story, like the headline of my interview is how to prepare for next year's inevitable heat waves you know, and that goes back to my initial point. We can't just sit here and wait for next year. And next year we're like, oh, it's so hot. How can we cope? So we cannot react to things as they happen. We know that they will happen. It's not a surprise anymore, even in the UK, in any part of the UK, really. So that's what I think policymakers should keep in mind. And I mean, everywhere as well, like everywhere else, you know, the EU emerged as a good example of regional plans in the interview. But, you know, there is still a lot to do in the EU as well, I think.
I think there's a lot to do everywhere.
Everywhere. The world is changing fast. Climate is changing fast. And we are severely underprepared. Anyway, on a more positive note, we're going for a short break where you can have a little rest and, you know, sit with this thought that we are severely underprepared. And Heather will have a story for us afterwards.
Ørsted is one of the world's largest renewable energy companies. With more than 30 years of experience, they are the global leader in offshore wind. With 6.2 gigawatts already installed across the UK, but they're just getting started and hope to invest a further £12 billion in Scotland alone in the next decade. They are taking tangible action to create a world which runs entirely on green energy, leveraging their capabilities and insights to help countries and companies in their green transformations as they accelerate the fight against climate change together. Follow the journey at orsted.co.uk.
We are back from the break and Heather has a story for us about Vera.
Thanks, Julia. Yeah. So I wanted to talk today about Vera updating the standards for its voluntary carbon standard. And I think this is important because it's really about the shaping of the carbon markets and the sort of ongoing controversy there. So to give a bit of background, for anyone who doesn't know, Vera is, I think, the biggest, if not one of the biggest, standard setting organizations for carbon credits. And they run their voluntary carbon standard program, which is basically they will approve projects that meet certain criteria and allow them to sell carbon credits to businesses, individuals, organizations, anyone who wants them, really. And when updating their standards, they've done a few different things. Basically, the sort of three main goals are to improve usability, increase integrity, and bring their standards into alignment with other global initiatives such as the Integrity Council on the Voluntary Carbon Market and the scheme in place for aviation as well. So to improve their usability, they've done a few different things, like they've updated project templates, they've added some guidance, put a bit of sort of clarity in place with many of their processes, whether it's their review or kind of how they go about or why they would go about denying a request. And then to increase their integrity, they've introduced a couple of different labeling types. So they're now going to mandate sort of a clearer distinction between greenhouse gas emissions reduction and actual carbon dioxide removal. They've also got a new label that just sort of identifies credits that are authorized for use under Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which allows countries to kind of transfer emissions reductions between them to help them meet their climate targets. I think most of the changes seem to be an effort to kind of strengthen Vera's alignment with the core carbon principles developed by the Integrity Council. So they've done quite a lot in terms of that. They've added quite a few requirements in terms of environmental and social safeguards. So these are sort of the measures that project developers would have to put in place to ensure that they're not doing any social or environmental harm elsewhere. So they've got things like preventing land use conversion and just some more formal procedures about obtaining the consent of the local community. They've increased the requirements for permanence monitoring. So that's sort of monitoring whether or not carbon is actually being permanently stored. They've increased that up to 40 years now. And just put some further clarification around their restriction of double counting and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of changes being made, But what I think this is important to discuss, because this isn't the first time the standard's been updated. It's, you know, this is version 4.5, I think, so it's been through several iterations already. And Vera has still been criticized. Vera's been criticized time and time again, often for its verification of reduced deforestation credits, or sorry, avoided deforestation credits. There's been a whole lot of criticism about whether or not these are actually effective. There's been criticism of Vera's receiving a commission for the project it verifies. All these sorts of things. And when I was writing this story, I spoke to someone from Rainforest Foundation UK, which has previously done a report on the dangers of relying on forest-based projects. And they were quite skeptical when I spoke to them. They sort of said, you know, we've not seen yet how this will play out, but I really can't see some sudden update to the standard just eliminating all of these problems that we've seen before. And I think that's a fair point, but then we need the carbon markets. You know, the discussions that we're having every single week about, you know, climate change is out of control, we've got extreme heat and everything. We really need to be channeling funding into projects that are going to help us, whether it's by sucking carbon out of the air or actually just reducing emissions. We need these projects, and in order to incentivize those projects, there needs to be some sort of system, some monetized system, because that's the language we speak these days. And I wonder how we find that balance between, you know, recognizing Vera's attempts to improve and also remaining critical, because frankly, there's probably still going to be problems. And we need to find a balance there.
I think there's a couple of different challenges that are connected with this story about Vera. The idea that credits get certified based on an agreed methodology is to a degree reasonable. And certainly as we learn more about science, we learn more about ecosystems, it's only right that these standards and these methodologies would be updated. It's a work in progress and that should be respected. At the same time, I think there are challenges sometimes in the way in which Vera has responded to questions. So for the last 6 months, there's been big discussion about this West et al. Research article in Science, which is the piece of research which said that the credits issued by avoided deforestation projects, and I think it was 14 different projects that they focused on specifically, but that the credits issued really hadn't done very much to avoid deforestation. Now, part of the problem with that is because avoided deforestation basically allows a company or a landowner to say, I will not deforest this area and you will pay me for not cutting the trees down. So it's kind of, that is poacher and gamekeeper at the same time. So I think that's quite challenging for people to get their heads around. At the same time, I think there are lots of questions around whether the market is the right solution, especially when it comes to things like biodiversity. I think you're absolutely right that we live in a sort of neoliberal capitalist society, and therefore using the markets as a tool to drive changes in economic behavior is the swiftest, most reasonable, most acceptable tool that we have. But I think there are just all these really complicated questions that all come together in one story. And I think it's really, really hard to unpick. So, you know, this story basically is talking about new principles created by a new body and how that's driving change in certification bodies. It's about whether the markets are the right way to solve the problem. It's about whether or not, if we decide markets are the way to solve the problem, whether avoided deforestation is actually a reasonable approach. Because if you make the comparison of avoided deforestation, so not cutting down existing forest, versus the idea of removing CO2 from the atmosphere, that's such a fundamentally different discussion in terms of issues around permanence and ownership and behavior and proof. And I think what's really challenging about this is, because of the complexity of the discussion, it is putting a lot of corporate buyers off. You know, we've seen reports that some of the large retailers like Nestle or luxury groups like Gucci are pulling back. We've certainly seen Shell pull back from its carbon offset plan, although to be fair, I think that's got more to do with the fact that the new chief executive is doubling down on profit maximization from fossil fuels.
It's also because Shell had its own projects.
Yeah.
Implemented its own project and then realized that they weren't working as they wanted them to work.
But that comes back to Heather's point about it's a process. We're learning.
Yeah.
What you don't want is for Shell to kind of learn it's not working and dump everything. You want to take those lessons and make it better.
Yeah, because companies want the silver bullet solution, especially a company like Shell. You know, I'm not shocked that they saw that it wasn't working in the short term. And so they're like, oh, this doesn't work. It's not doable. You know, you need to work at it.
I think that's a really important thing here. I think there's a tension between casting Vera to one side and saying, oh, look, your standard isn't working. Your standard isn't delivering what
definitely
we want.
Definitely not recommending
to.
That.
But then there's also, you know, if we're not going to do that, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone that actually argues that, yeah, we should dismiss the whole thing. So if we're not going to do that, then we need to come to terms with the fact that this is going to be a continuous process of improvement. Things are going to go wrong. There are going to be things that people aren't happy about. But, you know, we need to support the evolution as best we can. So, I mean, to me, sort of the thing that I took away from this story was, yeah, that's great. They've made some improvements, but also keep asking questions. Keep doing it because, you know, yes, it probably makes Vera's life pretty difficult, but we do need to keep asking questions because only then can we hold ourselves to a higher standard and, you know, implement better quality standards worldwide.
Well, what it boils down to is that very basic fact. If you don't question, you don't learn.
And as journalists, I think we're all on board with the questioning approach. So I'm advocating for that. And if you guys would care to join me, then that's the message we're putting out.
100%.
Absolutely. I think it's important to have scrutiny. And it's happening everywhere, isn't it? We're just scrutinizing all the sustainability initiatives, which is very important.
Oh, that's quite a good link to my story.
I think so. Yeah. It's moving to ESG and the States, the never-ending saga, after the break. Have you been searching for the latest sustainability news, developments, insights and analysis? Why not have it delivered straight to your inbox? Sense of Sustainability is the weekly newsletter for individuals and organizations committed to a more sustainable future. Each issue is designed to equip your business with the tools it needs to thrive in an inclusive, sustainable economy. Join the conversation and head to sgvoice.com/signup to sign up for our newsletter. We are back from the break for the last part of the podcast, and Felicia will talk to us about voting behavior and ESG in the States.
So basically, my story this week doesn't seem to be that big a deal in news terms. It's basically just an analysis that shows that both BlackRock and Vanguard have lowered their support for ESG measures. But the reason I picked the story is because it brings in so many different elements of a conversation that it's absolutely necessary for us to have. So I think BlackRock this year supported only 7% of proposals at board level. And just for those of you who aren't clear, both of these companies are asset managers. They have significant shareholders in companies. Therefore, they can have a real impact at board level when they vote on resolutions. So BlackRock only supported 7% of social and environmental proposals in the year to June 23. That was down from 22% the previous year and down from 47% in 2021. So on the surface, this looks like a massive collapse in BlackRock's support for social and environmental issues. This is especially interesting given a lot of this is in the States, and that's where a lot of the anti-ESG rhetoric is being driven. Vanguard itself, over the same period, so it only also supported 2% of these kinds of proposals, compared to 12% in the previous year and 20%. In 2021. Now, what's really interesting about this is that, as I say, on the surface, this looks dreadful. But one of the arguments that both of these asset managers are making is that the reason they're supporting fewer of these proposals is because they are less useful They are less economic. They are less practical. And what they're suggesting is that companies' performance on ESG has improved sufficiently that a lot of the challenges that, you know, they're being asked to face are being addressed, however slowly, and that actually it's just the quality of the proposals put forward aren't that good. You know, that they're perhaps overly prescriptive. Now, one of the things that's particularly interesting to me about the US market is that, you know, in most jurisdictions, when shareholders vote, it basically means a decision is made. Whereas in the US, as I understand it, it's a suggestion. If you're external and you're a shareholder and you put forward a proposal and it's agreed on, it's a guideline. It's something the company can choose to respond to or not. But I think, you know, one of the people who should know a great deal about it, which is Andrew Behar. He's the chief exec of a nonprofit group called As You Sow, which actually looks a lot at shareholder resolutions. And he actually says, you know, that this is actually quite a positive sign in terms of what's actually happening at the corporate level. And I think this is the key part of the conversation we need to have. So, you know, there has been massive pushback in the US. We've seen insurance companies tumble out of the Net Zero Insurance Alliance because of pushback from state pension funds and from politicians. Obviously, there's pushback from the pension funds as well. In fact, New York has just filed a motion to overturn a call to ignore fossil fuel, basically. There was a court case basically demanding that New York pension funds were not allowed to consider the climate risk in fossil fuel reserves for their long-term investments, which just seems so anti-common sense as to beg a belief. But that's my perspective. Everyone's entitled to their own. I know, Julia, you want to jump in. Let me just finish with this, which is this thing that what we're really seeing with ESG, if people like Behar are saying that we're seeing more action at the corporate level, is we are seeing companies ignore this anti-ESG rhetoric. Perhaps the language has changed. But actually, if you're going to manage risk effectively, if you're going to identify new opportunities, you cannot afford to ignore the underlying reality of ESG concerns, because environmental, social, and governance challenges are the very things that companies have to overcome in order to succeed.
This is exactly the point that I wanted to make. And this is something that I found encouraging from what Andrew Behar said, that even though at a somewhat high level, at policy level, insurance level, asset manager level, there is this anti-ESG. It's a rhetoric, you know, it's not rooted in reality. So the companies don't see an advantage for the business itself to follow it, which is why these votes from BlackRock and Vanguard, especially from BlackRock, you know, it's a big drop. And there are questions whether BlackRock just wants to make the anti-ESG faction happy, because it's been criticized from both sides, you know, by lowering its support to ESG proposals. But ultimately, whether BlackRock votes against or in favor, it doesn't matter, at least in the States.
Well, I think what drives the conversation for me is if you look at risk, the risk to business, the risk to investment is transition risk and policy risk. Sorry, transition risk and physical risk. Transition risk is policy risk. We're seeing on the ground the impact of physical risk from extreme weather. And we're seeing the impact of regulation and policy frameworks. There is a fundamental shift in our economic framework that is beginning to take place. There's a huge opportunity, because if you look at how companies explore their own impact, their own footprint, scope one and two, even scope three in the supply chain, if you look at scope one and two, the impact that a company can have can be orders of magnitude less in their scope one and two emissions than it is not just in their supply chain emissions, but also in how they help their customers change their own operations. Do you create a new technology that completely transforms a sector? You disrupt something. We're literally, the way I look at this is that we are in a process of change from an old paradigm. We've got policymakers and politicians who are stuck in a historical way of thinking about the world. The world is fundamentally changing. We're at the beginning of the transition. And, you know, we're not even at the end of the beginning, because if you look at the energy sector, that has been going through transition for some time, and we're still seeing the doubling down on fossil fuels. We're still seeing countries rushing off to the global south to look for new sources of oil and gas. But that historical model is no longer fit for purpose. It doesn't deal with the risks that we have to face. And we're seeing massive incentives and regulatory frameworks. In the US alone, the Inflation Reduction Act is expected to drive massive investment in the green economy. In Europe, the Green Deal is driving exactly that same kind of change, except through regulation. And this is beginning to happen everywhere. So we really need a massive rethink in the way in which decisions are made.
I think this is what I find so, you know, morbidly fascinating, I'm going to say, about the ESG debate, is that you look at things and you just think, how ignorant can you be to think that you can ignore this? Because
now, Heather, we can't talk about people being ignorant, because that's going to get us into the same problem that Hillary Clinton got with deplorables.
I am not speaking about any individuals. So let's take the example of an unnamed agricultural company or something. You know, if they choose to ignore environmental and social issues, they're going to end up with no supply. We've seen the impacts of climate change. They're not going to have a business. And it doesn't take the creation of some novel technology. I mean, sure, that can help. But even a small change in practices can make the world of difference. And I just can't quite get my head around why you would choose to actively stand against what is fundamentally a risk mitigation approach. It doesn't make sense at all. And it worries me.
No, listen, I agree with you. I agree with you, but there is this fundamental problem. What it boils down to is you are taking a longer term view. You are not looking at how much you can maximize return in the next 3 months. And fundamentally, what I see, and I could be wrong, but that anyone who understands the implications of climate change is thinking about the longer term. And I don't, when I say longer term, I don't mean 2050. I mean 5 years from now.
I mean, when we're talking about BlackRock and Vanguard, we're talking about investment. Investment is long term by nature. That's the whole...
No, it's not. That's the problem. It should be. And pension funds should definitely be thinking long term. But people who are running businesses, and investment is a business as well, those asset managers, they have to make reports every 3 months on what's going on. And the short term risk of being sued in Texas is probably higher on a priority list, rightly or wrongly, than the potential loss in the supply chain in 5 years' time for an agricultural company, for the very simple reason that people, this is still not part of mainstream conversation. There's lots of mainstream conversation about climate change, but it's not mainstream conversation to look at the economic models within which we operate, the timeframes over which decisions are made, and the particular drivers of decision making by those with investment decision power or corporate decision making power.
I think there is a lot to unpack here, because BlackRock, it has been so heavily criticized and threatened by the politicians to be taken off the pension funds and so on. And it's BlackRock is now acting from a political perspective because it wants to make everyone happy.
It's still making investments in a different way.
I mean, also, you know, BlackRock had some funds that were called ESG full of fossil fuels. So, you know,
That's an entire... we need to have another session talking about that, because the way in which the label is used...
Yeah, it's a $1 trillion asset manager. A lot is going on in that company. But also from a political perspective, it's convenient to say, oh yeah, it's fine, we can continue with business as usual. We don't have to change things, because people are terrified of change. And so you win a lot of votes by saying, no, guys, it's cool. Like, let's just continue with this. So I think that's why it's so convenient for some politicians to be anti-ESG. I mean,
I do think it's just a very short-term thing, and what we need to do is ask our politicians to think on a longer-term basis. I'm going to come back to the concrete discussion earlier, or the question of permanence. I know, it all interconnects. Are you thinking about solutions for the long term, for the adaptations that we need to make in order to thrive, or are we not?
I think that's a great point to wrap up on, Felicia. Thank you very much for the great chat today. And to our listeners, don't forget to follow us on all social media, check our website, and remember to follow the podcast so you never miss an episode. Sustainable Growth Out Loud is brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice. Bookmark sgvoice.net and subscribe to our newsletter for weekly insights and exclusive content. And follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter for expert analysis and commentary from right across the sustainability landscape. Subscribe to Sustainable Growth Out Loud on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've enjoyed this episode, then leaving a rating or review will help others discover it too. If a colleague or a friend may be interested, then sharing this podcast is the best way you can help us to grow. Thank you once again, and we hope to see you back for the next episode of SG Out Loud.